Hi everyone, welcome to the weekly question and answer session for members of the Personal Paleo Launchpad. I'm Laura. I have a master's degree in public health nutrition and will soon have my dietetics license.
And I'm Kelsey, a registered dietitian with a master's in human nutrition and functional medicine.
Thanks for joining us for this week's question and answer session. We'll be answering your questions from the Q&A question submission form, so if you have a question about the Personal Paleo Code or about nutrition in general, let us know by submitting your question to the form, and we'll do our best to answer it on the next show. Remember, this is just general advice and should not be used in place of medical advice from a licensed professional. So let's get started with our first question. Kelsey, this one's for you. It's a little long, so I'm going to read it out.
All right.
Do you know of any sort of reason why eliminating dairy would help relieve seasonal allergies? I have been paleo for a few years, so I haven't had any wheat in a long time, but I've been consuming dairy until I eliminated it when my daughter came down with ear infections. I usually get horrible seasonal spring allergies, but I noticed I didn't really have any symptoms of allergies last spring until I accidentally consumed some dairy while on vacation. Since I wasn't careful about asking to eliminate butter from anything I ordered, I immediately noticed my allergies kick in, and I remembered my mom's chiropractor told her to eliminate wheat and dairy from her diet for her seasonal allergies, which did relieve them. Why would dairy be aggravating my seasonal allergies, and is there any way to get around this, or do I need to eliminate dairy forever to avoid seasonal allergies?
Yeah, so this is an excellent question, and I have to say that I've heard a lot of stories like it before. But unfortunately, there's just not a ton of research out there to prove why this may be, you know, one way or the other. But we'll talk about some of the things that may be coming into play, because it's really interesting that this seems to happen for a lot of people. So the first thing I want to mention is that, you know, everyone is different and has different sensitivities. So while it's common that, as this listener mentions, gluten and dairy elimination are often pretty effective for reducing seasonal allergies, it doesn't mean that people may be able, you know, might be able to take out other foods that might significantly decrease their allergies too. So the first thing that comes to my mind when we're talking about seasonal allergies is the fact that a paleo diet is a type of elimination diet that usually gets rid of a lot of major allergens. So a typical strict paleo diet usually gets rid of dairy from the beginning. So, maybe this person had eliminated dairy from the beginning before but introduced it again, or maybe she just decided not to take it out from the beginning. So a strict paleo diet gets rid of dairy usually from the beginning, along with other allergens like wheat and soy. So when I think about any type of allergy or sensitivity, I start to think about intestinal permeability or leaky gut, as a lot of people may have heard it being called. When we eat foods that we're sensitive to, this can cause leaky gut, meaning that the epithelial cells, which are those cells that line the intestines, they start to spread apart, that leaves a gap that's not normally there. And food particles, usually it's a protein that's not quite digested fully, can slip through that gap, and they're seen as foreign particles by our immune system. So that sort of activates the immune system, and that whole process can cause even more sensitivities or allergies to develop down the road too if this keeps happening. So by taking out a lot of these potentially offending foods, that lessens the burden of allergens that the intestine has to deal with, and that can start to help heal intestinal permeability if it's present. And, you know, from what I know about intestinal permeability, I would guess that most people who are suffering from any type of allergy, whether that, is some allergy where they're getting some hives, or if it's seasonal allergies where you're just getting that runny nose, kind of, you know, the typical seasonal allergic response, my best guess is that they have some degree of intestinal permeability. And as Chris has mentioned before, as a part of Alessio Fasano's research, he's kind of shown that any type of autoimmune reaction basically needs to be preceded by having intestinal permeability. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case for allergies as well, that you sort of need to have intestinal permeability before you can even develop an allergy. And then it's sort of this vicious cycle where once you have allergies or sensitivities and you're still consuming those foods, that causes even further intestinal permeability, which causes more allergies and sensitivities. So I think that can really play into this here, because when you're taking out those potential sensitivities, even if you don't know if you're sensitive to them yet, that process can help to heal the gut, because once you take out the things that are kind of causing that intestinal permeability, those cells can start to come back together like they normally are. And then usually that decreases any kind of allergies, sensitivities. It helps autoimmune conditions. So I would imagine that that's going to do a lot for someone with seasonal allergies. Second, a paleo-type diet is anti-inflammatory, and allergies are a type of inflammatory reaction. So by reducing inflammation, we help to lessen that inflammatory response that we might have, you know, in relation to being exposed to seasonal allergens. So, but the question comes to, why did this person see a resolution of their allergy symptoms when even after being on a paleo diet with some dairy for some time, after they eliminated dairy, why did it go away after the dairy came out? So as I've mentioned, I've definitely heard this before from people, so I don't think this is an isolated case we're talking about here. And it could be that this person has a fairly severe sensitivity to dairy that maybe they just didn't know about before. I'm not sure if she took out dairy when she first started or if it was never something that had been taken out completely. So this may have been the first elimination and challenge test that she did for herself, including dairy. And especially since she mentions that the only dairy that she started eating was butter, that, you know, her food on vacation may have been cooked in. And for most people, this wouldn't cause such a kind of severe reaction where really you're noticing almost immediately that your allergies are coming back. So to me, it sounds like a pretty big sensitivity to dairy that's occurring there that she just may not have realized before. And that could be because, you know, she's sensitive to the dairy, but it never really shows itself until springtime when she's getting those allergies. So that could be part of the issue why she never noticed it before. Now, another thing that comes to mind when I'm thinking about dairy and allergies, you may have heard that dairy causes excess mucus production, which is why you sort of hear that you're supposed to avoid dairy when you have a cold or something like that. So this one's kind of a mixed bag from the research I've seen, and I think it's possible that because when we're talking about dairy, there's just so many different kinds. There's raw dairy, there's A1 versus A2, there's ultra-high pasteurized, high-temperature pasteurized dairy, there's fermented dairy. It's just a lot to consider here when you're looking at the research. So most research looks at milk consumption, and I think we can probably assume that they're drinking regular, you know, supermarket milk, but that may not be the case. And most of the research says that there's not more mucus production from drinking more milk. So this may be a complete myth. However, I want to bring this up because I think it's certainly possible that some people may find that they produce more mucus, or they just feel kind of more, you know, clogged up, plugged up in their nose and everything when they're drinking or consuming dairy of any kind. And that's kind of what some of the research has said too, is that if people believe that they have a reaction to it, those are the people that they find actually do produce a little more mucus. So whether that's placebo effect or it's just that these are certain people that are having that reaction, it's not quite clear. But since everybody's an individual and has their own individual sensitivities, it's important to just keep in mind that you are your own guide. Whatever the research says, it doesn't really matter. If you get clogged up from or get allergies from drinking dairy, then that's you and that's how your body reacts. So unfortunately, we just don't have all the answers yet. And, you know, I like to answer these types of questions just to show that there's not a ton to go on sometimes, you know, speaking of research, and that really your body is your guide. And just because science can't provide the answers doesn't mean that we shouldn't listen to what our body is telling us. So to me, you know, hearing this situation, it sounds like a dairy sensitivity that just was not realized from the beginning. And so if you want to keep your allergies at bay, you're best off eliminating your dairy consumption. So I know this probably isn't the answer that this person was looking for or hoping for, because it sounds like she wants to consume dairy, but it's probably the best for your body to reduce, at least reduce your intake, if not eliminate your intake, especially since if it was only butter consumption that gave you that reaction, it sounds like you're pretty sensitive to it. But one other thing before I sign off on this question here that I thought of as I was reading this question is that she mentions that she had the dairy when she was on vacation and that that's when she noticed the increase in her allergies. Now, I don't know if this person drinks when they're on vacation, but I definitely do, and I think a lot of people do, and this can definitely cause an uptick in allergy symptoms. And that's because alcohol, particularly drinks like wine, it contains histamine, which is what our mast cells produce when we're having an allergic reaction. So it may have been that having a few drinks over the course of her vacation pushed her over that histamine threshold, and that's why she started having allergic symptoms. Now, of course, I'd have to hear more from her and know more about the situation, but that was something that immediately came to my mind too. Sometimes, you know, when we hear these things like dairy can lead to allergies or wheat can lead to allergies, that's what sticks in our mind when we start to have an allergic reaction. And so we immediately sort of blame those things, but it could be something else entirely. So what I want to say here is that it's definitely possible it was the dairy. You know, certainly that could be the case, and it sounds like that was the biggest change that you had in your diet. But try to think about some of the other things that may have changed, you know, being on vacation versus being at home. What other dietary changes were going on? Were you drinking a little bit more? Were you eating other things that you weren't normally eating? And try to figure out what may have caused those allergy symptoms to flare. So just keep your mind open as you think about what may be contributing to any symptom you're having, and try experimenting with different things because everybody's different and we just have to follow what our, you know, experimentations lead us to. So that's all I have to say about this question. Laura, would you add anything else here?
Yeah, I'm just, as I've been reading the question, I just noticed that she never really mentions what she means by dairy, except for that one instance where she mentions butter. And for me, I would be curious to know what type of dairy she's generally eating.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, like a organic cheese or something that she buys at the grocery store, if it's kefir, if it's like raw dairy, like you mentioned, because there is some anecdotal evidence that would suggest that raw dairy doesn't have the same effect on allergies, or exactly. It might even be protective against allergies compared to normal milk. So again, that's an anecdote. I've just read people saying that they cured their allergies using raw milk. So again, not a scientific recommendation, but it is something to think about, what type of dairy you're eating. And I do think that fermented dairy is probably a little less problematic than something like fluid milk or even maybe butter, because it does have those beneficial bacteria that might help digest some of those more problematic compounds.
Yes. Well, actually, one thing I will say, just in case, you know, I did mention that the wine thing about her. So if it is that she's a little bit reactive to histamine foods and it's, you know, something like that, then fermented dairy in that case may make it worse. So yeah, but you're right. It could be that would make it better for some people. And then for other people where the histamine is an issue, then it could make it worse. So going back to self-experimentation always, you know, is key. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that the raw dairy thing, like I said, it's not scientific by any means, but it's worth giving it a shot if you really want to to make dairy a part of your diet, which it seems like this person might be on the fence about whether they care or not. But if it's something that this person really wants to keep in their diet, then looking for a raw source could be a potential way to get around the allergy issue. So.
Right, because, you know, she was saying she was having the dairy on vacation. Usually that would mean that you're probably eating it in a restaurant, which usually they're not using the best sources of dairy when they're cooking in bulk like that. So that's another, you're right, that's absolutely another thing to consider, is the, kind of the quality of what dairy you are consuming.
Right. And then one other thing is that if it's just the seasonal spring allergies, maybe you just avoid dairy for the springtime, and then, you know, you're not so strict around fall or winter when the allergies aren't an issue. Because I don't think if you eat butter in, you know, like October, that you're going to have worse allergies in March or something. So it could just be like a seasonal dietary shift where you, when you are having your allergic symptoms, then you can just avoid dairy for that short amount of time.
Absolutely. That's a great recommendation. Cool. All right.
That was a really good answer. I guess the next question is for me, right?
Yes. So what is the difference between paleo and Atkins? I mean, there are some obvious differences, but I feel like the very foundation is the same: high protein, high fat, low carb.
Okay. So I do have to say that I disagree with this listener's interpretation of what a paleo diet is, or rather what it should be. But I also admit that this is a really common misconception that we tend to address frequently in this question and answer session. I like to keep talking about it because obviously new people coming to the question and answers may not want to go all the way back to, you know, a year ago when we first started talking about carbs. But carbohydrates have got to be the most commonly misunderstood components of a paleo diet, especially because many people who are new to paleo are generally being exposed to information provided by people who are somewhat anti-carbohydrate, or from those people who believe that carbohydrates actually directly cause weight gain, or that by reducing or eliminating carbs as much as possible, you can cause weight loss in every individual. And then there are also the low-carb proponents who suggest that carbohydrates cause neurological disease or advanced aging. And while low-carb diets can be effective for treating diseases like Alzheimer's disease or seizure disorders or brain tumors, that doesn't mean that the consumption of carbohydrates directly causes those outcomes in the majority of people. Okay, so there are some significant differences between Atkins and paleo. The first being that paleo doesn't really have a prescribed macronutrient ratio to follow, whereas Atkins does have a prescribed macronutrient ratio. Atkins is mainly focused around carbohydrate restriction, and it also encourages higher protein intake in general. In the induction phase, which is the first 2 weeks, they suggest that dieters eat no more than 20 grams a day of carbohydrate, and at least 12 to 15 grams of those must come in the form of things like salad greens and other non-starchy vegetables. So if you follow those instructions, you're basically eating a zero-carb diet, in my opinion, because digesting those non-starchy veggies requires glucose. And I'm not really sure what other food you can really eat to get an additional 5 to 8 grams of carbohydrate. So I just kind of, as a joke, suggested it's about 6 M&Ms or a fifth of a banana. So I don't really see people doing that, you know, like eating their non-starchy vegetables and then adding a fifth of a banana for that extra 8 grams of carbohydrate. So they'll probably just be completely avoiding starches and sugars during that phase. And it's essentially a ketotic diet unless the protein intake is high enough that the dieter gets kicked out of ketosis. But that's a whole other story for another time. Strangely enough, however, you're not even allowed to eat nuts or seeds in the first 2 weeks of the induction phase. And they also suggest using sucralose or saccharin as a sweetener, or it's a non-nutritive sweetener, which I don't think is a good idea. And I am getting this information directly from the Atkins website. So this is the company's protocol for the diet. You might have seen other recommendations on other websites, but I'm just going from the official Atkins, you know, company. And then after the introduction phase, which is a minimum of 2 weeks, you can slowly start adding carbohydrates back in as you desire. And they recommend starting with foods like nuts, seeds, strawberries, blueberries, melon, cottage cheese, and yogurt. And I don't really think nuts and seeds have much carbohydrate to speak of. I think it's just a couple of grams per ounce.
Yeah.
But they are included in the stage 2 diet additions for carbohydrates. And you're supposed to increase your carbohydrate intake every week or two by 5 grams per day. So that means you might go from 20 grams per day in the initial, what's that phase called again? The induction phase. And if you increase by 5 grams per day every week, that means you might get to 40 grams per day at the end of the month if you're a quick transitioner. And 40 grams a day is still pretty low. And they also say that maybe you don't even want to increase for a whole month by 5 grams a day. So trying to get up to a what I would call a moderate carb diet would probably take a really long time, weeks, months, possibly even like a year. And they recommend that if you start to plateau or regain weight, you're supposed to, at a minimum, pause your carb increase. So instead of increasing by 5 grams again, you just don't increase at all. Or you are supposed to cut back on carbs by 10 grams a day. So maybe you're at 40 grams a day and your weight loss stalls, then potentially you're supposed to cut back to 30 grams a day. So then phase three is supposed to start when you're 10 pounds away from your goal weight, which could take many months, if not a year plus, if you're significantly overweight. And once you've reached your goal weight and maintained it for a month consecutive, you can move to stage four, which is basically the lifelong maintenance phase. And that phase is based on the number of carbs you are comfortably eating while maintaining your weight. So there's no real set carbohydrate amount that they've determined to be acceptable for them. It's just it's based on the stage that you're maintaining the weight that you've set as your goal and not having an issue with it. So there's a lot of information on their website about the rules and about the foods you should eat, but those are the basic rules of Atkins. And they do recommend getting protein and fats from whole food sources such as meat, fish, and eggs, and then also including low-carb dairy foods such as full-fat cheese. And then they recommend getting the bulk of your diet volume from non-starchy vegetables. So that's things like lettuce, spinach, kale, I'm trying to think of some other ones that are pretty low carbohydrate.
All those like green, yeah.
Yeah, green vegetables, and then things like carrots or squash, some of them are pretty low as well, or depends on how many you eat, but usually higher in fiber and less carbohydrate. But on this diet, they also allow vegetable oils such as soybean and canola oil, as well as some other questionable items like soy milk, diet soda, using Splenda as a sweetener. And they don't really seem to discuss food quality on the site. I mean, I didn't go into every single page that they have, so it's possible that they address it. But from the recommendations they were making for food, it didn't seem like food quality was a major component. So I would potentially assume that conventional beef is no different than grass-fed beef on the Atkins diet. And possibly in the short term, you know, I don't think that you're going to have a huge nutritional difference from those two. If you're just, you know, switching it out for a meal or even for like a couple weeks if you need to kind of cut down on costs. But in the long term, conventional beef is not going to be providing the same level of nutrients as grass-fed. And also, my biggest beef with Atkins, no pun intended, is that the products that they sell under the Atkins brand name, such as meal replacement bars and shakes, or they have frozen entrees, or they even have candy and that kind of stuff now.
Wow.
But these, yeah. So these foods actually have a bunch of really nasty ingredients in them, including things like soy protein isolate, sucralose, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this artificial sweetener, so you might have to correct me, but it's acesulfame potassium.
Please, I'm not going to even try with that.
It's like the, I think it's like Sweet and Low or one of those other artificial sweeteners, but it's pretty bad as far as what research suggests that it might do with things like cancer and that kind of stuff. But they also use things like canola oil, safflower oil, and other industrial seed oils. There's lots of different food colorings in certain items, especially like the candies and the bars. And there's just a bunch of really gross non-food ingredients that allow these items to taste good while still being low carb. So if you're doing an Atkins diet and you're relying on a lot of these pre-packaged products, I don't think that it's either healthy or sustainable in the long term. And I actually just wrote on my personal blog an article about SlimFast and about how SlimFast was ranked so much higher than the paleo diet in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. And the SlimFast products have very, very similar ingredients to what the Atkins products have too. So I would toss those Atkins products under the same, umbrella as SlimFast as being not really food, first of all, and second of all, not being a healthy diet to maintain over the long term. So I would say this demonstrates the two main differences between Atkins and paleo. Atkins is a strictly low carbohydrate diet, and it doesn't necessarily emphasize food quality. And in some cases, it completely throws quality out the window in ensuring that the food is low carb, and that is the case for its packaged products. And paleo, on the other hand, could be actually comparatively high carbohydrate depending on your personal needs, and it has a strong focus on food quality over anything else. And at least this is the paleo that Chris describes in your personal paleo code. And there are lots of people that eat what they would call a paleo diet, and they might be eating over 200 grams of carbohydrates per day and maybe even more. So that's definitely not a low-carb diet. And these carbs are generally coming from healthy sources like starchy plants such as root vegetables, potatoes, sweet potatoes, different types of fruit, or even natural sweeteners like honey or maple syrup. And in Chris's version of personalized paleo, you might even get carbohydrates from properly prepared grains or legumes, which is not strict paleo, but those foods are likely not a problem for people who are generally healthy and tolerate them well. And maybe those are the obvious differences that this person was talking about when they wrote the question, but I think the key thing here is that paleo means very different things for different people, but ultimately the focus is on eating primarily whole foods from properly raised sources, and including healthy levels of exercise, sleep, and stress management to optimize the use of the nutrients you're eating, and, you know, not just focusing on one specific component of the diet to specifically modify.
Right. I think if you want to focus on any one thing, focus on eating real food. And that's, you know, what I love about paleo is that there's such a focus on food quality. And that's what I see missing from a lot of other diets out there. And as you mentioned, you know, the U.S. News report about the diets, and just so many of them are just terrible diets. Yeah. And it makes you realize how many bad ones there are out there and how focused paleo is on real food, that it's just surprising that they rank all these so much higher than paleo. But right. I guess we're going to get some flack.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the way I see it is, it's like, if a lot of these diets focus on limiting carbohydrates or, you know, just cutting calories, honestly, the way that the U.S. News ranks them, you could almost just eat like either, you know, 2,000 calories worth of Twinkies and then right. a multivitamin. Or if you're trying to do low carb, you could do like, you know, 30 ounces of steak and again, take a multivitamin to make sure you're getting the nutrients that are technically absolutely required. And it's like, I mean, obviously that's a really overgeneralization, but I don't really like these diets that, I find them to be kind of gimmicky. And then also just the ingredients are so terrible. And it's like, yeah. They're not real food. You have no idea what they're going to be doing to you. Like these artificial sweeteners and the industrial seed oils and all the additives that kind of like add to mouthfeel, because if you take fat out of a food, it doesn't have the same mouthfeel. So they have to add like
right.
types of gums and fillers and wood pulp and that kind of stuff.
Which just sounds so appetizing.
I know, right? I guess it is a diet, right? So, but yeah, and then there's just so many ingredients that are in there that are linked to poor outcomes like cancer or, you know, heart disease and that kind of stuff. And it's like, why, even if they work for weight loss, why would you sacrifice your long-term health just to lose weight?
Right, when you can do it a better way. Yeah, definitely.
Right, and maybe they're quicker. Maybe you would lose weight faster doing Atkins because, you know, if you go on a ketosis diet, you're going to lose weight pretty rapidly, whether that's a sustainable weight loss or whether you're going to regain that weight is, you know, not for certain. But I just feel like I would rather see someone change the quality of their diet, eat like a moderate level of calories to the point where they're eating enough, but they're not like, you know, just eating all day, whatever they want kind of thing, and allowing themselves to have treats once in a while, but really focusing on just cooking their own food, eating real ingredients, and maybe once in a while having these kind of Frankenfood treats if they really like them. But yeah. I do find that the more you eat real food, the less you enjoy these kind of
right,
fake
it tastes
foods.
Disgusting after a while of eating real food.
Right. So anyway, that got a little off on a tangent there. But I do think that this is kind of one of those comments that is pretty frequently seen in like the media or for people that are just new to paleo, and all they see is like the recommendation to eat lean meats and non-starchy vegetables and healthy fats. And that's right. it. And it's like, okay, well, you know, carbohydrates can be a good component of that too. And they're not evil and they're not, you know, going to necessarily cause disease in the majority of people. So
yeah,
I don't know. It just gets really, you know, hairy when people start to make assumptions about what is good and bad about whole foods, you know?
Right. So. And yeah, so I love that people ask this question to us because we get to explain it. And I think that's where a lot of these problems come from, is the misconceptions about the paleo diet that are, you know, propagated in the media, like you mentioned. And right. That can be definitely problematic for paleo's image. And we want to, you know, our end goal here is to just get as many people as possible eating real whole food. And, you know, paleo is the way that we choose to do that, but it could be any way they want to, as long as someone's tolerating it well, in my book, you know, that's fine by me. And so, yeah, I love that we get to explain this to people so that they realize what paleo actually is versus what they may have heard about it elsewhere.
Right. And maybe this gives people a good idea of how to respond when friends or family give them a hard time
about
the way they're eating. If they're, you know, if they're doing paleo and their, you know, best friend says, oh, that's just a glorified Atkins diet. Well, now you can kind of explain what makes your diet different, and hopefully the person will understand and maybe they'll even be curious about it.
Yeah, definitely. So that was great, Laura. Thanks for that.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's one of the most common questions. So I feel like answering it every couple of weeks is kind of an idea. So, but anyway, thanks for joining us, everyone. We hope you enjoyed these question and answer session. And remember, you can submit your question in the form on the Personal Paleo Launchpad website, and we'll do our best to answer it on the next show. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you around next time.
All right. Take care, Laura.
Thanks, Kelsey. You too.